This week on Making Contact.
We have a water shortage in the sense that we're using more water than nature can provide us with.
We have Tampa Bay, which is a very shallow waterway, and we're dumping this very concentrated brine discharge into this shallow estuary.
You build the plant on the coast and you desalinate water, and it's a lot cheaper just to dump our wastes locally.
Only a slim percentage of the world's water is usable for human consumption. More than 97% of it is salt water. In some areas, where there are shortages of fresh water, people are turning to desalination plants, facilities that can remove salt from ocean water. On this program, we take a look at this technology and what it means for the environment and our outlook for water supply. I'm Stephanie Welch, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. According to Peter Glick, director of the Pacific Institute for Studies, Development, Environment, and Security, there are thousands of desalination plants in use around the world. Many operate on a small scale in the United States. The process of removing salt from water is not so complicated, says Glick. But, as he tells Making Contact's Philip Babbage, when desalination plants operate on a large scale, there are economic and environmental impacts that must be considered.
It's possible to take salt out of water through heating up the water and evaporating it, which leaves behind the salts, and then capturing the evaporated water and condensing it again. There are some more modern techniques, such as something called reverse osmosis, where salt water is passed through a membrane, and the membrane traps the salt on one side, and the water goes through to the other side. And they throw away the very salty brine, and they keep the fresh water. So there are a whole series of technologies available for desalinating water, but we've never used them in very, very large quantities.
It sounds like those are fairly simple processes. Is it not as simple as you're describing it?
Well, the technologies are relatively well understood. The problem is less a technological problem than an economic problem. Desalination is very expensive. It takes a lot of energy to take these salt ions out of water. And so the challenge is really the cost and coming up with technologies that can reduce that cost.
Mm-hmm. What are the benefits of using desalination?
Well, the benefit, of course, is that there's this possibility of making this vast reservoir of salt water available for human use. The oceans are just too salty to drink and too salty to use to irrigate our crops and too salty for most industrial purposes as well. And there are many parts of the world and many parts of the United States where fresh water is increasingly scarce, where we fight over water resources politically or economically. And gee, if there were unlimited quantities of fresh water available from the oceans, some people think all of our water problems would be solved.
Mm-hmm. What about, are there any cons to using desalination technology?
Well, the biggest, of course, is its cost. It's just very, very expensive. Now, there is also one of the byproducts of desalination is you get two streams of water. One is this stream of fresh water, which is what you want. The other stream is the remaining salt that's been stripped out. We call it brine. And that brine is much saltier than the oceans, and that has to be disposed of pretty carefully. You don't want to dump it on land because it contaminates the land. If you dump it back into the ocean, which is what we mostly do with it, you want to make sure that it's pretty well mixed and that you're not harming the local ecology or anything else.
Mm-hmm. So that brine then can change the balance within areas in the ocean, say, where that the waste is dumped then.
Yeah. For example, you absolutely would not want to dump that brine in a wetland or a marsh. That's easy to do. You build the plant on the coast and you desalinate water, and it's a lot cheaper just to dump our wastes locally. But that sort of brine would be devastating to local ecosystems, and it's pretty important that we be careful about brine disposal, and that's one of the major environmental concerns. And the other issue actually is, as I mentioned, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to desalinate water, to strip those salt ions out. And so desalination is a big energy consumer. Now, if we burn fossil fuels to desalinate water, we're contributing to all sorts of other kinds of environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, do we need to start turning to desalination to address, say, water shortages in the United States?
Well, I have mixed feelings about desalination. We know how to do it. in situations where we really have no alternatives and we have very high-valued uses for water, certain kinds of industrial processes that require really, really pure water, desalination may make sense. But for the vast majority of the United States, even for areas where water is scarce, such as parts of California, parts of the year, there are alternatives that are cheaper and faster and cleaner and more environmentally sound than desalination still. And so we should, for example, look at improving water use efficiency. If we can desalinate water for $1.50 a cubic meter or $1.20 a cubic meter, we can save water and hence produce new water available for use for 20 cents a cubic meter, much, much less.
How inefficient would you say we are currently in our water usage?
I think we're tremendously inefficient in our current water use.
Is it people taking showers too often, or is it industrial agriculture?
I would never argue that taking long showers is inefficient. If people want to take long showers, they should take long showers, but they should pay for the water they use, the real costs of that water. If we want to flush a toilet, that's fine. Let's flush the toilet, but let's do it with a technology that minimizes the amount of water necessary to achieve the goal. Our goal isn't to use water. Our goal is to achieve certain things that we want. That would be an improvement in efficiency. If we can do what we want to do, take the showers we want, but minimize the amount of water that's required.
What do you think the future of our water resource is?
Well, there are plenty of water problems, and the problems differ from place to place. I think the greatest failure is that it's the year 2001, 2002 practically, and there are still 1.1 billion people worldwide without access to clean drinking water and 2.4 billion people worldwide without access to adequate sanitation services, something we in the richer countries take completely for granted. And that has got to be considered the most serious development failure of the 20th century. We fail to meet basic human needs for water. And I think that problem remains to be solved. We still are taking water from our natural ecosystems and have not promised our natural ecosystems the water necessary to maintain their health. The ecosystems still get short shrift when it comes to water, and I think we need to change that. We need to commit basic water requirements for natural ecosystems.
Any last thoughts?
Well, there are a whole series of new problems potentially facing us. The issue of global climate change is a real problem and is going to have very serious impacts on water resources that we're just beginning to understand. Ultimately, we have to think about using water more efficiently and not thinking just about desalination, which may have a limited role to play, but at using our water more wisely and more equitably.
Peter Glick, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
At first glance, desalination seems to offer an ideal solution for localized shortfalls in freshwater, since seawater is an abundant resource. However, as one community in southwest Florida found out, a desalination plant may pose a threat to the environment, and determining its impact is a complex process. Making Contact's Hillary Beach has more.
The rumbling noise of the Big Bend coal-fired power plant has been a fact of life in Apollo Beach, Florida, since 1970. So has pollution. The plant, which is owned by the Tampa Electric Company, has a history of violations of environmental regulations. Residents living 2 miles from the plant wipe coal dust off their decks and kitchen counters daily. When the Florida Department of Environmental Protection failed to enforce environmental regulations, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency stepped in and sued. A settlement was reached in 2000, requiring Tampa Electric to undertake numerous pollution reduction steps at Big Bend over 10 years and pay a $3.5 million penalty. Now the Big Bend power plant is at the center of a new environmental debate. Beginning in the late 1990s, a combination of abnormally low rainfall and fast development led to a crisis for Tampa's drinking water supply and the environment, according to Ralph Brooks, attorney for Save Our Bays, Air, and Canals, or SOBAC, a local activist group.
Tampa Bay Water has pumped the wells so hard that they have caused lakes near these well fields to drop as much as 10 feet. That's had devastating impacts on the littoral zones of the lakes and the associated wetlands. What Tampa Bay Water has done in response is look to seawater as a means of reducing the need to pump groundwater.
The Tampa Bay Water Authority called for proposals for a desalinization plant to purify estuary water into drinking water. The winning bid came from Tampa Bay Desal, formerly S&W Water, which proposed building a reverse osmosis desalinization plant at Big Bend, next to the power plant. The company said this would offer a unique way to dispose of the main waste product from the desalinization process, a concentrated saline solution. The power plant uses water drawn from Tampa Bay for its cooling system and discharges this water back into the bay. Tampa Bay Desal proposed piping the briny waste product from the desalinization plant into the next-door power plant's wastewater discharge, where it would be diluted up to 70-fold before being released into the bay. The company said that this would not harm marine life in the bay. Sobac took issue with this assertion and challenged Tampa Bay Desal's application for a wastewater permit. While not opposed to desalinization per se, Sobac members wanted to see the brine concentrate disposed of in another fashion, such as piping it offshore into deep water. Sobac member Patricia Mitchell says these options were not given serious consideration for the Big Bend site.
We have Tampa Bay, which is a very shallow, shallow waterway, and we're dumping this very concentrated, the largest power plant, reverse osmosis in the world, that brine discharge into this shallow estuary. On the other side of the county, Pinellas County, they decided that they had to have a pipeline, and here on this side of the county, they're not. This is political, not scientific.
Tim Defoe, Director of Project Development for Poseidon Resources, which owns Tampa Bay Desal, maintains that other methods of brine disposal were looked at, but that they were less economical and lacked the dilution benefits of mixing with the power plant wastewater. Sobac pressed for improvements to the power plant's water cooling systems. In particular, Sobac wanted to assure that the water discharged met the minimum legal standards for levels of dissolved oxygen deemed necessary to sustain marine life. Sobac attorney Ralph Brooks.
This power plant doesn't recycle any of the water that it uses. It's called a once-through cooling water system. New power plants use recycled systems, and they have what's called a cooling water tower. That's something that we've asked for in the Tampa Bay desal permit. We've said that if you're going to piggyback this $110 million new desalination facility on to a 35-year-old power plant with antiquated technology, it's time to retrofit that cooling water system. Go ahead and recycle it. Go ahead and put on cooling water towers so that you can actually meet the state water quality standards. If that was done, a big part of our problem would be solved.
But Tampa Electric resisted these suggestions, in part because of the high cost, according to Brooks. Without improved cooling technology, Patricia Mitchell contends that the blended discharge from the two plants poses a major threat to bay marine life. She has particular concerns about the harmful effects of insufficient oxygen levels and excessive levels of phosphorus and nitrogen, or nutrient loading, due to the combined discharge.
The desalination plant is going to combine its concentrated brine discharge with the cooling water from TECO. That is helpful, but we still have a problem with the dissolved oxygen levels as well as the nutrient loading. The TECO discharge alone has difficulty being in permit compliance for dissolved oxygen levels. A brine discharge independently has trouble complying with dissolved oxygen levels. Now we're going to combine this discharge into an estuary and a shellfish propagation area, and it's going to have suppressed dissolved oxygen levels, which is going to harm the marine life.
Tim Parker, Water Management Program Administrator at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, confirmed that the power plant's discharge does at times violate state standards requiring a minimum level of 4 milligrams per liter for dissolved oxygen content. Dr. Michael Champ, former government senior scientist during five presidential administrations and an expert witness for Sobac at the permit hearing, says he thinks that Tampa Electric is getting away with too much.
Their argument is that the bay water that they're currently using as intake water is sometimes during the year and in some areas predominantly below 4 to begin with. And therefore, that they've already gotten water that's impaired. And even though they impair it just a little bit, their discharge is still not above 4.0. And 4.0 is the federal minimum requirement that fish and organisms can live in. So it's kind of like saying to you, well, everybody parks illegally here, therefore we can all park illegally here.
Tampa Bay Desal claimed that since water is aerated during the desalinization process, dissolved oxygen levels in the combined discharge would actually be boosted whenever the power plant's water intake levels of dissolved oxygen were below 5 milligrams per liter. The impact of the desalinization plant on dissolved oxygen levels was only one of many highly technical topics addressed at the wastewater permit hearing. Sobeck also claimed that the high levels of salinity in the discharge would harm marine life. Separate teams of environmental experts representing Sobeck, Tampa Bay Desal, and the local Hillsborough County Environmental Protection Commission presented data obtained from computer models of the bay. Tampa Bay Desal's Tim Defoe summarizes his site's findings.
Our scientists have taken a look at what is the impact of salinity on the bay and what are those salinity changes proposed to be under some very extreme cases. And the result is that in the immediate area, right adjacent to the discharge of the plant, the change in salinity brought about by the desalination plant is well within the natural variation that you see every day in that bay.
Defoe points out that a separate model commissioned by the Hillsborough County Environmental Protection Commission yielded similar results. Sobeck's model, created by Dr. Carl Goodwin of the U.S. Geological Survey, showed that the discharge would take much longer to spread out and be fully mixed with the estuary water and could harm marine life. The judge discredited his findings, however, arguing that his model was outdated. Despite Sobeck's challenges to the wastewater permit, many environmental organizations came out in support of the Tampa Bay Desal proposal, including Tampa Bay Watch, the Florida Audubon Society, Save Our Springs, the Florida chapter of the Sierra Club, and the Coalition to Save East Pasco. In fall 2001, following the hearing, the judge recommended issuance of the permit as specified. Both parties filed exceptions to the recommended order and are awaiting the final ruling from the Secretary of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection. Sobeck might still appeal this ruling. Meanwhile, construction continues at Tampa Bay Desal, with the plant set to provide 25 million gallons a day of drinking water by the end of 2002. For Making Contact, I'm Hillary Beach.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about this program, please visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Located within commuting distance of Northern California's Silicon Valley, coastal cities and water districts inside Santa Cruz and Monterey counties are taking a serious look at desalination plants. An acute need for new sources of fresh water in the Santa Cruz-Monterey Bay area is emerging primarily as a consequence of high population growth. Making Contact's Diane Solomon has more.
Within the heart of this region is the Monterey National Marine Sanctuary. This sanctuary extends 276 miles north and south of Monterey. The sanctuary contains 5,322 square miles of ocean. The sanctuary, in conjunction with other state and local agencies, is charged with reviewing all requests for permits to operate desalination plants within its boundaries. At present, at least a dozen permits are in process. Holly Price is the Resource Protection Coordinator at the Monterey National Marine Sanctuary.
A number of concerns that we have about desal include the brine itself, of course, that it could potentially have impacts on the invertebrate communities, kelp beds, anything living on the bottom of the ocean. And so we actually have a prohibition against discharge into the sanctuary, and we also have a prohibition against disturbing the seabed, which would happen if there are any kind of pipes or construction associated with these plants. Now, we can issue a permit for these facilities, provided we can work with them to reduce the impacts to a level that we consider short-term and insignificant. That's kind of our threshold. So we're looking at it as something that potentially we could approve, but there has to be some fairly stringent environmental conditions before we would be able to authorize that.
Holly Price adds that there are many environmentally sensitive areas at risk.
The Monterey Bay Sanctuary actually is home to the greatest diversity of species in the temperate regions of the ocean. It has 345 species of fish, there's 94 species of seabirds, 27 species of marine mammals, and thousands of marine invertebrate species. Unfortunately, there's not a great deal of data about desalination impacts. What we do know is that certain kinds of invertebrates, like echinoderms, the sea stars, sea urchins, that kind of thing, tend to be more susceptible to variations in salinity. But we really think there needs to be substantially more monitoring of elevated salinity impacts to help us in the future decision-making processes.
Desalination plants are being considered by the cities of Santa Cruz and Watsonville, as well as by the Soquel Creek Water and Monterey Peninsula Water Management Districts. Nearby, the city of Marina has a desalination plant which provides about 15% of the municipality's water supply. Bruce Daniels is an elected director of the Soquel Creek Water District and is a vice chair of the California Regional Quality Control Board. Daniels says that there are integral relationships among desalination, new development, and costs to the public.
One of the main reasons to put in, for our district, to put in a new plant is to allow for new development, for new people coming in. And if you do that, is it fair to have all the existing people pay more when there's water for them? We don't have water for the new people. And is it fair to have the existing folks essentially subsidize new development? So the economics of this are quite fascinating, about who is going to pay for this, how much will they pay, will there be differences of rates between existing people versus new people, and it's a tough issue that we certainly haven't faced since we haven't gotten that far, but it's going to be something I think all of us need to look at is, you know, how much is it worth?
In addition to environmental concerns, Daniel says desalination has a high price tag.
Well, there's certainly some considerable cost in the facilities. There's something like $20 million or something like that, depending on the size of the plant, goes up and down. But, you know, a huge chunk of money to buy the facilities, to get it installed, to get the permits to do that. So there's an upfront cost. There's a facility cost. And then there's a considerable operation cost. They work through membranes, these essentially plastic sheets with tiny little holes in them. And they have a limited life, so they have to be replaced on a fairly regular basis. And then they also work through pumping up the water in high pressure, and that requires a lot of electrical energy to do that. So there's a considerable electrical energy cost associated with it as well. And so you end up, at the end of the day, with water that's something like twice the cost of just pulling it up out of the ground. And so it's significant, but if it's a question between living and not living, I think people are going to be willing to do that rather than face the alternative of having no water.
But how severe is the water shortage in the counties of Santa Cruz and Monterey? Dr. Chris Harold is the Director of Research and Conservation at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, an important educational center that focuses on this region and its connection to the world's oceans.
We have a water shortage in the sense that we're using more water than nature can provide us with. I think that we perhaps wouldn't, now I haven't gone through the math and I'm not a water engineer, but my sense is just in seeing how my neighbors live and how people live in this area that there's a tremendous amount of water that's devoted to keeping landscapes green that are nowhere near what a natural landscape in this area is. I don't know what proportion of the total water demand is landscaping water. I would imagine a fair amount of it is. So we're creating a water shortage by the way we use it. So in that sense, you're right. You know, is there really a water shortage? Well, there is in the sense that we're drawing more water out of the aquifer in the Carmel River than can be replenished. We're drawing groundwater in the Salinas Valley down, so there's saltwater intrusion. So we are using more water than I think this environment can provide us with.
Many believe that water conservation efforts can solve a significant portion of this area's water shortage. That may be true. Santa Cruz County has many water-thirsty parks, golf courses, and softball diamonds. Monterey County has over 40 parks and is home to the world-famous Pebble Beach Golf Course. Few golf courses in this region use reclaimed water. That's because reclaimed or recycled water contains chlorides, a form of salt. When it's used on golf greens, chloride levels build up, which burn and kill the grass. In the city of Santa Cruz, water use is currently measured at 76 gallons of water per person per day. This reflects Santa Cruz's long-term commitment to water conservation. Per capita use in the Monterey Bay and Central Coast area is 113 gallons per day. California's per capita use is 138 gallons per day. The city of Santa Cruz will pay over $10 million over the next 10 years to bring Santa Cruz's per capita water use down to 67 gallons of water per day from 76 gallons per day. The city of Santa Cruz believes it will then be as water efficient as possible. In spite of its intensive water conservation efforts, if there is a drought similar to the drought of 1976-1977, the Santa Cruz Water Department estimates that it will be 48% short of meeting average demand. After it implements its $10 million program, the Water Department estimates the city will still be 45% short. Is desalination the only alternative? Dr. Chris Harold.
My view toward desal is I think we need to question whether that's the right strategy at all. I mean, desalination, you know, brine discharge is one impact. Desal is a very energy-intensive process. It takes pumps pumping water at very high pressure through membranes. And I'm just wondering if that's the right large-scale solution to our water problems. It seems to me that a lot more effort and emphasis should be placed on reducing our use of water rather than figuring out a way to create more water that really isn't there. I mean, this is a Mediterranean climate. It's pretty arid. And my sense is that we as a society in this area really haven't adapted our lifestyle to what this rainfall climate is, and that's providing some pressure to build these desal plants. And I'd like to see, you know, a lot more emphasis on water conservation and kind of shifting our lifestyle to be more consistent with the Mediterranean climate that we have.
Santa Cruz's efforts demonstrate that water conservation will only solve part of the problem. Critically examining population growth, new development, landscaping styles, and recreational choices, many observers say, will also have to be part of the mix. For Making Contact, I'm Diane Solomon.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at desalination. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Damian Irizarry for production assistance. Philip Babbage is our managing producer, Laura Lavati, managing director, Peggy Law, executive director, associate producer, Shereen Meraji, women's desk director, Lisa Redman, senior advisor, Norman Solomon, national producer, David Barsamian, administrative coordinator, Rosalind Fay, and I'm your host and associate producer, Stephanie Welch. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. You can also go to our website at radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.